This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Rabbi Berger was at the Shalashudas today, and he continued a theme that I started last night, really, which spoke about the importance of enjoying life, and that the Ribbono Shel Olam created us to have pleasure. The difficulty with that is, it all sounds fine and it's all beautiful. The difficulty with it is that there's a Gemara against it. And that is, the Gemara says, and several times, things, statements such as "lefum tzar o igro," that the more you suffer, the more there's reward. So what is the perspective? What is the correct perspective? Were we created to have a good time, or were we created to suffer? If we were created to have a good time, why do we get more reward when we suffer? And if we're created to suffer, why does the Ribbono Shel Olam instruct us in so many different ways to have pleasure, to enjoy ourselves, to have a good time too? Let us understand that concept of lefum tzar o igro, that the reward increases commensurate with the suffering that we have during our lives here. The Midrash says, in this week's Seder, the well-known Midrash, and I've spoken about it before from different perspectives. Ma'aseh b'talmid echod sh'Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. There was a case with a particular disciple of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Sh'yotzo chutzolorets, he traveled overseas. Uvo oshir, and he came back from overseas a very wealthy man. V'hoyu ha'talmidim ro'yin ha'isoyim mekanin boy. And the disciples of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai saw this, and they were very jealous of him. And they also wanted to go out to Chutz Loretz. They saw this was a good thing. The man went out to overseas, and he traveled and did well, came back a wealthy man. They wanted to do the same. But Yoder Rabbi Shimon knew about that. And he took them out into a valley, and he davened to Hashem, and he said, "Biko, biko, mili dinore zob. O valley, fill yourself with golden krugerrands." Hibchilo meshechis dinore zob lifnehem. The gold just came pouring out of the hills, and the valley started filling up with these gold coins. Amalohem, he said to his students, "Im zob atem bevakshim. If you want gold, you don't have to go traveling to America. Hare zob, take as much as you want. It's all here. Tzlu lochem." But there's one thing you need to know. Kol mishu noitzel achshov, anybody who helps himself now, chelko shel olam habo hu noitzel. He's taking a portion from his olam habo. He's getting paid in advance. Shein matn schar ha-toyro el al olam habo. Because the reward for Torah is an olam habo. So if you want to be paid up front in hard currency, no problem, it's all here. Help yourself to as much as you want. But you need to know that it comes off the cheshbon, that at the end of the day this comes off your final payment. So here we get some kind of idea of lefum tzar o igro. Obviously their choice was, we're not told, but it's quite clear, that they said thank you very much, and the gold went back into the sides of the mountains. And they didn't help themselves to one single coin. Who would go and exchange part of his own olam habo for a gold coin? And they went back to their poverty. So we begin to understand the perspective of lefum tzar o igro, that the reward later on is commensurate with the suffering here, because the more you've suffered here, the less you've been paid. And the less you've been paid over here, the more is available for you there. Someone understands it. And what does that mean, really? It means that anything more than bare necessities is in fact being paid from your Olam Haba account. And that's quite worrying. That's quite concerning to people who are living on a standard of living which is above bare necessity. And what is bare necessity? When we talk about bare necessity, what are we talking about? The Medrash goes on. Ma'aseh b'Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta. There was a case with Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta. Shebo Erev Shabbos v'lo haya lo ma'an l'hispanes. That Erev Shabbos arrived and he had nothing to eat. Yotzo lo chutz min ha'ir. So he went out of town to a quiet place. V'hispalel lifnei ha'elikim. And he davened before Hashem. He said, Ribono shel Olam, Shabbos is about to come in and we have nothing for Shabbos. We can't, no wine, no challah, nothing to eat. Kitchen's bare. The Nisan lo even tova min hashamayim. And a precious stone came down from heaven. Nosna la shulchoni. He gave it to the dealer. Ufine so it's a Shabbos, and he was able to buy a beautiful Shabbos. He gave the precious stone to the dealer. He got money, and he took the money to Shabbos' kitchen, and he got a whole Shabbos organized. He comes home to this impoverished home where there isn't anything at all to eat, and he starts taking out the pekerach, the challahs, and the gefilte fish, and the prepared meat, and the roast chicken, and all the vegetables to go with it, and the sauces, and the desserts, and a bit of whiskey to go with it, or plenty of wine for kiddush and for the meal. His wife didn't know what was happening. So his wife says, and where does this come from? He answers, "Bimai shepirnes hakadosh baruch hu. Comes from God. Ribbono shel Olam gave it to me." I don't accept this. If you don't tell me the truth, where this came from, I'm not touching it. So he told you the story. I davened before Hashem, and this came down from heaven. I won't touch anything unless you promise me that you'll go and buy that precious stone back again after Shabbos, and you'll give it back to God. They want it. He said to her, why are you being so stubborn? She said, do you want to have your table empty in Olam Haba and your friends' tables will be full? So good, so for Shabbos we've got nothing to eat, not the end of the world, but do you want to sit in the world to come? Do you want to sit in Olam Haba and there's nothing on your table and your friends' tables are full? In other words, what is she saying? This is your Olam Haba, you're being paid from your Olam Haba account. Where do you think this comes from? There's nothing for nothing in this world. If you've been given this comes from your Olam Haba account. So we get an idea from that, a perspective of that, of what we call more than bare necessities. That means even to be able to afford food for Shabbos comes from an Olam Haba account. That's what emerges. Even to afford food for Shabbos comes from an Olam Haba account. The absolute bare necessities of survival. If you've got enough food to survive, just to stay alive, then anything more than that comes from the Olam Haba account. Now, this approach causes people to take certain views on life, which is that, then not only is it not important to do well financially, but it's in fact that it's a count against you. In fact, it's a liability to do well financially. And it causes people to get all guilty if they do well, and it causes them to look down, it causes them not to do well in their professions, it causes them to become real schleppers. And we need to analyze it, and we need to understand it. Is that really so for people like us? Does that apply only to great people like that? Or would that apply even to people like us? The fact that we were able to drive here this evening, we didn't have to walk or come by horse and cart, the fact that we've had what to eat this Shabbos, the fact that one or two of us might still be able to afford to go out to Shulas for some coffee and cake afterwards, is that our Olam Haba account? When you walk past Shulas on a motor Shabbos, are you watching people eat up their Olam Haba account? Or is that's they don't know, that's the income, and the Olam Haba stays where it is. Based on the shiurim I've given the Shabbos, I want to explain this by saying that for us, luxuries are necessities. And there are two ways one can understand that. The Briskers have an interesting approach, the Soloveitchiks. They don't like luxuries, irrespective of what they can afford. Even if they can afford it, they won't buy anything that you don't need. So for example, you'll very seldom find carpets in their house. You don't need carpets. What do you need carpets for? You can manage in a house without carpets, also fine. The carpets don't they don't perform any real function. So no, you don't need carpets. The Briskerov's son married an American girl. Not the elder Briskerov, one of the younger ones married an American girl. She comes from America, she's not going to move into a house without carpets. Not only that, she wanted carpets, she wanted a lounge and a dining room suite, and she wanted the right kind of bookshelves in the rooms and so on. And there was a lot of muttering going on. What's happening to Brisk? The younger generation are softening, and look at this kind of thing, look what's happening. And Rebbetzin Soloveitchik said to me, what they don't understand is that different people's necessities are different. If you've been raised in Yerushalayim and your father didn't have carpets in his house and your grandfather didn't have carpets in your house and you've never lived in a house with carpets, no, that's not for you, it's not a necessity. But if you've come from America where you've grown in houses where there's a lot more than that, then it is a necessity. She says, just as the same, I have a fridge in my house, she said, Rebbetzin Soloveitchik. I have a fridge. My grandmother didn't have a fridge. Does that mean that a fridge is a luxury? Doesn't mean that at all. Today, a fridge is a necessity. That's how life is today. People have to be adaptable and have to understand that the definition of luxury and necessity changes. But we can go further than that, because we've got to decide necessity for what? How do you judge a necessity? The fact is, you can't survive without a carpet. The fact is, you can survive without 99% of the things we buy and the things we own. Does that mean that those things are all luxuries, that those things are all things that we're taking off our Olam Haba account? Because you could survive, you could remain alive without having those things. What do we mean when we talk about a necessity? A necessity for what? A human being is not just meant to survive. An animal is meant to survive. That's his instinct. He's meant to survive, to remain alive, that's all. And to remain healthy. That's all an animal has to do. And another animal doesn't have all sorts of psychological problems, nor does he have great emotional and spiritual ambitions. His job is to keep alive, that's it. If we were to say that all we need is that which we need to keep alive, we would be reducing ourselves to the level of animals. If we said the fact is we can survive without a motor car, we can survive without a carpet, we can survive without a swimming pool, we can survive without all these things. That's true. We can survive like an animal survives. But can we survive like a human being? Human being, when we talk about surviving, we talk about not remaining alive in the biological sense, but remaining alive in the life force sense, being a lebedik, a human being. That's what it means, lebedik. Being a human being who is alive, a human being who has a sparkle to him, a human being that has life to him, that's what our survival means. And when we check what is a luxury and what is a necessity, we've got to ask ourselves, is this a necessity for being lebedik? Is this a necessity for being happy, for enjoying myself? Is this a necessity for having a sparkle in my life, to be able to walk with a stride? Is this a necessity? That's what we've got to ask ourselves. Not if this is a necessity to remain alive, to survive like an animal. That's not what it is. And so we've got to look and say, what do we need to be alive human beings? And that differs from person to person. That differs from circumstance to circumstance. One of our difficulties, as I explained in the lady's shoe this morning, is we tend to derive our enjoyment from the things we have. That's what we derive our enjoyment from. We enjoy what we've got. We enjoy our family, we enjoy our children, we enjoy our grandchildren, we enjoy our homes. If we're fortunate, we enjoy our work, we enjoy the things we can afford, we enjoy the holidays we can take, we enjoy the things we've got. The things we've got, if one's blessed with some kind of bracha, it's a wonderful thing. One has certain things that one can enjoy, but there's no question that there are more things you haven't got than you have got. So we limit our enjoyment enormously by only enjoying the things we've got. What about enjoying things that we haven't got? Or what kind of emotion do we arouses in us when others have got things that we don't have? And material things is only half the problem. Material things is half the problem. Somebody's got a beautiful home and we can't afford such a home. Touch of jealousy, touch of resentment. What did he do to deserve it? Somebody travels overseas on the QE2 and has a lovely time. We can't do that kind of thing. Touch of resentment. The material things are only part of it. What about the emotional things? What about the non-material things? Another person gets some covet, he gets some honor, he gets an aliyah in shul, I'm overlooked. He gets recognized, I'm overlooked. He gets a promotion, I'm overlooked. When it comes onto those areas, we get very, very miserable. We get very upset, we get very uptight. We're not able to enjoy that which other people have got. We can only enjoy that which we have got. And so we are exceptionally limited in our capacity for joy. Because to be happy to enjoy something, we've got to have it. Can't enjoy something that we don't have. It's like the difference between enjoying a painting in your own home and being able to go to an art gallery and enjoy the painting even though you don't have it. See, it's not yours and it could never be yours. You could never afford it. Still, to have a look at it and find pleasure in it and enjoy it, that's something one can do. And so why should not one not be able to enjoy all lovely things and beautiful things and experiences that other people have as well? There's a lovely Gemara that gives one an interesting perspective on all of this. We don't know what poverty is. Rabbi Akiva is kaddish le brose the kalba savua. Rabbi Akiva became engaged to the daughter of kalba savua, who was a wealthy man. Shomo kalba savua, when kalba savua heard that his daughter was marrying a talmid chacham, adro hano mikol nichse, he made a vow that his daughter and son-in-law would have absolutely no benefit from anything he possesses. As love is nasibale besitvo. That didn't break the marriage. The two of them got married in the winter. Havugami beitivna. They lived in a haystack. Imagine the great Rabbi Akiva. He wasn't the great Rabbi Akiva yet, but he was to be the great Rabbi Akiva. And his wife, the daughter of this millionaire, are living in a haystack. Have a komankit leitivna min mazi. Every day when they got up in the morning, they used to have to take the straw out of their hair. That's how they used to go. Omalo, and he used to say to her, if I had it, ramina lech Yerushalayim didahava, I would give you a golden Yerushalayim. That's where the name of that song comes from. I would give you a Jerusalem of gold if I had it. I would give you everything if I had it. Ato Eliyahu idmi lohon ka'ansha. Eliyahu appeared to them and appeared like a man. V'kokari abova, he came to the gate of the yard in which the straw was. Omalu, and he said to them, Havuli puta de tivna, is there any chance you could lend me a little bit of your straw? The yaldut isasi velesli miyadim laaguna, because my daughter, my wife is about to have a baby and I don't have a place for her to lie down even. I don't even have any straw for her. And the Rishonim say that Eliyahu came like in the form of a man, kedei lenachem oisom, to comfort them, ulahar ois lohem shigesh anihim yoseh mehem, to show them that there are some people who are even poorer. It's like Pollyanna's glad game. Well, you know, things are bad, but you can be happy, you should be glad that it could be worse. Look at this man, his wife's about to have a child and he doesn't even have straw, nothing. Omele Rabbi Akiva leintetei chazi gavru dafidu tivne. Look at this man, Nebuch. He doesn't even have straw. He's going to come and ask us for straw. Omrale, she said to him, Zil havi beirav. Go and become a Talmid Chacham. Go and learn. Ozal tatis resh. And he went to learn for 12 years, and you know the famous story. That's how it started. What do we see there? The capacity to find joy in somebody else's poverty. Not limiting his capacity, not to rejoice that person is poor, but to rejoice that what I've got is more than he. And to find happiness in that too. You don't have to possess something to find happiness. One can sometimes you need to realize, in order to find happiness in what you possess, you need to realize that there are some people who don't even possess that. The capacity for joy and for happiness is not only derived from your own circumstance, it's from comparing your circumstance with others who have less than you. Have a look around and see how many people there are that don't have anywhere near what you have. But to do that, you've got to be able to share in their suffering. When Rabbi Akiva says, look at this man, Nebuch, he doesn't even have straws. You can imagine the tears running down his face when he said that. You can imagine how he sobbed and how she sobbed. How they cried for the poverty of that person. Only when you can really share in the misfortune of somebody else and feel their pain and feel their suffering, can you then look at yourself, and no matter how difficult your situation is, and say, aren't I lucky? Aren't we well off? We've got straw at least. We've got a place to sleep. It's all we've got, but at least we've got that. There's some people who don't even have that. So the capacity to identify with somebody else's suffering is a primary requirement for expanding your own joy. Otherwise, the only way you can have joy is just in your own little world, in your own little environment, without comparing yourself, without seeing what's happening in the wider world. It destroys the capacity. And sometimes we think, no, I can't identify with that person's suffering because it would be too painful for me. No, identifying with somebody else's suffering makes you happy, not painful. Sure, it makes you it pains you at first. But that pain becomes a source of happiness because you're able to appreciate what you've got so much more. And what about enjoying what other people have got? What about when you look around and most people are better off than you? Here we have a big problem. I explained to the ladies this morning the relationship that existed between Moshe and Aaron. Moshe and Aaron were two brothers that worked very closely together. Two brothers who supported each other absolutely. And they formed a unit, they worked together and loved each other and respected each other and made the ideal partnership, the ideal brotherhood. And we think they were similar people from a similar background with a similar mission, but they weren't. There was potential for enormous conflict between Moshe and Aaron. Firstly, their philosophies of life were opposite, not similar. Moshe, the Medrash tells us, is the epitome of MS, uncompromising truth. And uncompromising truth usually causes faribbles and machlekes and all sorts of things like that. Uncompromising truth, usually it results in unhappiness among other people. And Aaron was uncompromising shalom, he was uncompromising peace. That at all costs there must be peace between people. And Aaron would be willing to compromise the truth, he would tell lies in order to create peace. He would tell one person that another person really respects him. And he would tell the other that he respects him, and the two will think that they respect each other when they didn't really respect each other. And that way he would bring them together, telling lies. Moshe would never do such a thing. Moshe put MS first and would not compromise the MS even for Sholem. Aaron put Sholem first and would not compromise Sholem even for MS. And so these are not only different worldviews, they're opposite worldviews. That means their style of interrelationships, their value systems, their missions in life, totally different and opposite and almost irreconcilable. Added to that, we have to understand that until Moshe came along, Aaron was the blue-eyed boy. Aaron was the leader, Aaron taught, Aaron was the Moed Asra, Aaron was the king, everybody respected Aaron, Aaron was the Novi. Moshe was, nobody knew where Moshe was, he ran away to Midian and he was anonymous, nobody knew where he was or what he was doing. And Aaron was carrying the load. Now all of a sudden Moshe bumps into the Ribbono Shel Olam at the burning bush, and all of a sudden Moshe is going to be the Yichus. All of a sudden Moshe is going to walk in and take the whole place over again. Potential conflict. Aaron could say, excuse me, I've been running the place while you've been all over. What, you're going to just walk in and take over again? Out of the question. He could have resented it. But the Torah tells us how when they met for the first time after this, how they met at Har Sinai, and they kissed each other. And they, from that moment on, they trusted each other, they respected each other, they supported each other absolutely. How is it that these two opposites, they're so opposite, as I explained this morning, that when the Ribbono Shel Olam created the world, Emesh said man should not be created, and Sholem said man should not be created. Chesed and Tzedek said let's create man, but Emesh and Sholem said you can't create man because man cannot reconcile Emesh and Sholem. Man cannot synthesize Emes and Sholem. A man might know how to be honest, but he's going to lose his friends if he's honest. A man might know how to keep his friends, but then he's going to compromise his honesty. You can't, if you want to keep absolute truth and absolute peace, you can't have human beings around. And the Ribbono Shel Olam throws MS out. Says, in that case, we have to compromise truth. God acknowledges that you can't have MS and Shalom together. That's how opposite these dynamics are. And Moshe and Aaron, each from those opposite schools, come together and work together for the rest of their lives and support each other completely. How do they do it? What's the essence of it? Explains the Medrash, Zeh somach bigdulosoy shel zeh, Zeh somach bigdulosoy shel zeh. What did it was that each found pleasure in the promotion of the other. Each found pleasure in the covered, in the dignity and the honor that the other was receiving. So on that day, if you would have gone into Aaron's house, you would have found he was throwing a party. He would have found the tables laid, food on the table, wine and whiskey on the table, and you would have come in and said, Aaron, what's the occasion? He would have said, we're celebrating. He said, Aaron, what are you celebrating? Moshe has been appointed the king, my brother's the king, my brother's been appointed to bring Bnei Israel out of Mitzrayim, we're celebrating. Join in. It's a wonderful move. So you would have gone over to Moshe's house to see what to say, Mazel Tov to Moshe. And you would walk in, you'd say, Mazel Tov Moshe, Mazel Tov. And Moshe would say, oh, and how do you know? Did you know? I've heard, just come drink a L'chaim. And you sit down, and Moshe would fill the glass with wine and say, L'chaim to the man of the moment, to my brother Aaron, been appointed the Kohen Gadol. We're celebrating. What's going on here? Aaron's celebrating the fact that you've become the king. You're celebrating the fact that Aaron's become the king. Yes, that's what they're celebrating. If you know how to, it's much more fun to celebrate somebody else's gedulah than one's own. Because your own promotion brings a lot of tzoros with it. Your own promotion, your own covered, your own position brings an enormous responsibility with it. But to celebrate somebody else's position, you have all the nachas with none of the responsibilities. Like a grandparent. Much nicer to be a grandparent than to be a parent. You can celebrate, your child has had a child. Grandparents are much happier than the parents are. Because when the parent's having the child, yes, a great simcha. But the parents also begins to worry. There's the little baby, and you start worrying about raising the baby, educating the baby, finding a shidduch for the baby. Do you know what it costs to raise a child, by the way? I had to do the calculation for on a certain occasion the other day. Do you know what it costs today? What it's predicted to raise a child from the cradle for post-university. At today's values, R1 million. R1 million per child. So there you've got this young couple, neighborhood battling to just come out to pay their rent and to more or less come out, and they're not really managing. And here's this little baby coming, and they say R1 million. Where is this R1 million going to be coming from? Well, so there's a lot of worry as well that taints the joy. But a grandparent says nachas, they've had a baby, the children have had a baby, how wonderful, there's a baby in the home. Only pleasure, no responsibilities. It's wonderful to be a grandparent. And so it is to celebrate somebody else's achievement. You've only got the nachas, you've got none of the problems. You've got none of the responsibilities that go with achievement. Why not celebrate it? So if you would have said, Moshe, but didn't you also become king? Moshe would have said, that's nothing to celebrate. I spent 7 days trying to get out of it. I spent 7 days trying to persuade the Ribbono Shel Olam to leave me alone, find a younger man, find a better man, leave me alone. I didn't want it. I'm not celebrating that at all. That's nothing to celebrate. That's an enormous, onerous task. I've become a servant of the people. That's not what I want. I've lost my freedom. There's nothing to celebrate. But Aaron becoming a Kohen Gadol, that's wonderful. And you'll run back to Aaron. And you'll say, Aaron, aren't you celebrating the fact that you've become a Kohen Gadol? I was here and drank a L'chaim. And you were drinking for Moshe. I didn't know you'd become a Kohen Gadol. He said, yeah, I've become a Kohen Gadol. What can we do? Yeah. That's how it is. These things happen to people. They say, but Moshe is busy celebrating that you've become a Kohen Gadol. He says, it's fine for him to celebrate. He doesn't have the responsibilities of a Kohen Gadol. Sure, he's celebrating. You're able to find so much more joy in the joys of other people than in one's own joys if one develops the capacity. And that way you can have a simcha every day of your life. There's always somebody who's achieved something. There's always somebody who's enjoying something. If we develop the capacity to share in the joys of others, sure, one can be a happy person all the time. But we don't. We look at what other people have got and we start wondering why, and we start wishing we had it, because we limit our capacity to joy to what we have. And unless we've got it, we can't enjoy it. Somebody else has got it, it's even worse than nobody having it. Rather that nobody have it than that he should have it. It's mishuga, it's completely mishuga. What difference does it make if he's got it? You haven't got it and you wouldn't have it in any case. He didn't steal it from you. He didn't take it from you. It's his own. What difference does it make to you if he's got it or if he doesn't have it? The fact is he got it and he's happy. Joy, enjoy the happiness. But we find that hard, we find it difficult, and so we limit ourselves. Souls and narrow ourselves, and we make life very until they say enough, you've given more than your share. The Major says it was the same with Klal Yisrael. They were collecting money for the golden calf, they gave for that. They're collecting money for the Mishkan, they gave for that. That means the Medrash is suggesting that Bnei Yisrael was totally indiscriminate in the way they gave their money. In that case, why did the second one, why were they atoned? Why did the money they gave to the Mishkan, why did that atone for the money they gave to the golden calf? What's the one going to do with each other? And what's the meaning of the story of the young man who comes to town? It's a difficult Medrash for us to understand because we're so far from it. A young man has been in the village, he's got money. He's been working, he's got money. But nobody ever needs his money. Doesn't have a family, hasn't been able to do anything with his money. How does he feel when he comes in and he's approached as he walks into town and somebody says, excuse me young man, do you think you could help us? There's a family that needs some money, we're trying to raise some money to help them. How does he feel? Wonderful, fantastic, there's an opportunity to help, somebody needs me. Somebody needs my money. And he gives. Why is he giving? Because he knows who the family is. Because he identifies with the family. Does he know whether the family are tzaddikim or they're not tzaddikim? He doesn't know and he doesn't care. The fact is somebody asked him for money. He's happy. And down the road somebody else is asking for money. It's for nonsense. It's for building a theater. He gives money to that as well. Why? Because he loves giving money. He just enjoys the feeling of being able to give. And so it was with Klal Yisrael, the Medrash says. Hashem thought originally when they gave money for the golden calf that they were doing it because they had rejected him. And they loved the golden calf, they loved idolatry. When he saw that they gave money to the Mishkan with the same kind of generosity, he realized the reason they gave money for the golden calf wasn't because they loved the golden calf. It's because they never had an opportunity before to give money. They'd been slaves in Egypt. And then they came out, they became wealthy on the way out. Now they're in the desert. There's nowhere to spend their money, there's no one to give their money to, there's nothing they can do with it. It's so frustrating to have all this money and you can't do anything with it. They didn't need anything and there weren't any shops even if they wanted something. There were no investment opportunities. There was nothing. They had to carry the stuff around with them. And they could do nothing with it. All of a sudden they come to the golden calf and Aaron says, come, give me your gold. Let's build the golden calf. It was a wonderful opportunity to give. Because Klal Yisrael had not lost the joy of giving. We've lost the joy of giving. We don't enjoy giving. Last night I explained there are lots of things we don't enjoy. In fact, there's very little we do enjoy. Now we have to package our enjoyment in specific things. We've got to do specific fun things. Because everything else is no fun. You shouldn't need like that. The fact that Saul Kirzner is making such a lot of money is an indictment on our whole society. It means that in order to enjoy yourself, you've got to go to Sun City. You've got to schlep out of town and travel somewhere and go there to have a good time. What about the rest of your life? That means you're not having a good time. That's a problem. Because we've lost the capacity to enjoy the things that we do. And I gave the example last night, is eating on Shabbos a pleasure or a duty? It's both. Not a conflict. The fact that it's a duty doesn't mean it can't be a pleasure. The fact that it's a pleasure doesn't mean it can't be a duty. Is resting on Shabbos, is having a Shabbos all together, is saying a bracha on nice tasting food, all these things, are these pleasures or duties? They're duties and they're pleasures. There's hardly anything in our life that we shouldn't enjoy. Why don't we enjoy it? Because it costs. And we've lost the capacity to enjoy investment, to enjoy giving, to enjoy putting effort into something or someone. We've only have the capacity to enjoy what we receive. And we have to receive, and then we go into the taking business, because only taking gives us pleasure instead of giving. And the truth is that giving is a much greater pleasure, because as we said, if you can derive pleasure from somebody else's joy, let's go through the steps. The first thing is to derive pleasure because I'm happy. So good, so I get some money or I get a gift. That's a source of pleasure. Somebody gives me a lovely gift and I unwrap it and there it is. That's a source of great pleasure. It's one kind of pleasure. There's another kind of pleasure where somebody else gets the gift. And I watch him, and if it's somebody I love, we know that we have the capacity to do that. If our children get a gift and we watch the child unwrap the gift, and with this sense of anticipation, and he takes the paper off and he unwraps it and he opens it, and you look at this expression of total delight, and you hear this cry of joy as the child realizes what it is. What does that do to the parent? It makes the parent so happy. It's not your present, you're not getting anything out of it. Child's getting it. What are you getting happy about? That means we do have that capacity. Who do you think enjoys it more, the child or the parent? The truth is, the parent enjoys it even more than the child. It's a greater nachas to see the kid open the parcel than to open the parcel yourself. So we can get even greater joy from other people if we have the right relationship with the people. And there's one even greater than that. That's when you've given the child the present and you watch him open it. That's the greatest of all. So the smallest pleasure is what you receive. The bigger pleasure is to watch somebody else receive. And the biggest pleasure of all is to watch somebody receive something from you. I imagine if we developed that art, if we cultivated that art. We have it, I've proved to you that we've got it from our own children. So we have it. If we could extend that beyond our children, beyond our immediate family and our very close friends, if we could extend that a little bit further, to find that same kind of pleasure in the joys of other people, how much more pleasure we would be able to access. How much more joy we would be able to access. How much more fun we would be able to have in the things we do every day. The fact that something costs us doesn't mean it's a liability. That's what it's for. The young man who comes into town and his pockets are full of money. Bnei Yisrael traveling through the desert those first 7 weeks with their pockets full of money and nothing to do with it. It's painful not to be able to do with it, to feel totally powerless. I've got it and I can't do anything with it. To be able to use one's energy, one's emotions, one's thoughts, one's communication to make other people feel good and to delight in it and to take joy in that. And so yes, if somebody else has bought a beautiful big house with 2 tennis courts and 3 swimming pools and a billiards room and 6 motor cars outside, just to enjoy it with them and to say, isn't that wonderful that you've done so well, it's so nice, and to watch them enjoy it and to watch them take pleasure and to find pleasure in that as well. So much pleasure we could gain. And what's an eye in horror? When we talk about an eye in horror, that's the opposite. When somebody walks past and looks at it and thinks, what did he do to deserve that? Why him? And that makes us miserable, and that makes us unhappy, and that makes us small, that makes us small-minded, and we find ourselves suffering rather than enjoying. And so yes, if we go back to that earlier contradiction, let's try and resolve it. The Fum Tzar Uigra, on the one hand, yes, life is for pleasure. The Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to have pleasure. He wants us to enjoy. On the other hand, Chazal tell us, the Fum Tzar Uigra, the greater the suffering, the more the enjoyment. The more the reward. And what reward is it talking about? The Mishnah says, Kachi Darko Shel Torah in Pirkei Avos. This is the way of the Torah. Pas b'melach toichal. You should just eat some bread and some salt. The mayim b'meshura tishrei, and a little bit of water you should drink. V'ara oretz tishon, you should sleep on the floor. Im kacha toise, if that's what you do, ashecho b'olam hazeh v'toiv lach l'olam habo. You'll be better off not only in olam habo, in the world to come, but ashrecho b'olam hazeh, you'll be happier in this world. How can you be happier in this world? What does it mean you'll be happier in this world? That doesn't mean that a person who only finds pleasure in what he's got is meant to do that. That's not a recommendation to all of us to get rid of our houses or rent them out and to move into the servants' quarters and to sleep on the floor and to only eat bread and water. That's not what it means. It means one should be able to do that without diminishing one's pleasure. Then you should do it. If you can do that, then you should do it. But not that you should do that and be miserable. You should be able to do that and be happy. How do you do that? The only way you can do that, if your source of pleasure doesn't come from what you've got, but from what you give. If your source of pleasure doesn't come from what you've got, but from what other people have got. If that's unable to be a source of pleasure and to nourish you, we need pleasure for nourishment. We need happiness, we need simcha, we need nachas, we need it to live on. Without that we can't survive. In the terms that I defined at the outset, surviving in the sense of being alive, of being lebedik, not of just surviving. Can't be lebedik without that. Without joy, without pleasure, without simcha, without nachas. The question is, where do we derive our joy from?
from what we've got or from what anybody's got? Do we have to be happy ourselves in order to be happy? Or can we be infected by happiness? Is it possible to be infected by happiness? And if it's possible to be infected by disease, it's even more possible to be infected by happiness. And that might be part of what infectious disease is there to teach us. That people infect one another. And people affect one another, negatively and certainly positively. And if one can get ill from coming into contact with somebody, one can become well and one can become happy and one can become joyous in contact with somebody. It was a very, very interesting as I spent a couple of days practicing this pas b'melach toichal, eating only bread and water. I went to one of these health farms. And one of the things they had there was a very outstanding man. I want to get him to come and speak to the Beis HaMedrash, in fact. Not a Jewish man. He's an expert in sports medicine, but in doing so, he's really developed a philosophy of health and of medicine which is an unbelievably holistic, of a sense of well-being. His view is the same as the Vilna Gaon's, Lahavdil, and the Ramban's. He follows the Shita of the Vilna Gaon and the Ramban, and that is that if you're living properly, you don't need doctors. A doctor is a concession to faulty living already. If you need medication, there's something wrong with the way you're living. It shouldn't be necessary. That's it. Occasionally, yes, one can be infected and so on, but generally in terms of the normal kind of illnesses that people suffer from and the normal kind of medication that people take, it shouldn't be necessary. And in fact, it can be more destructive than constructive, and he's got an interesting approach on that. And part of the holism was, and he gave a lecture at this place which was very, very fascinating, and I've heard him before. But then he said, I want to show you how it's not only health, it's not only exercise and diet. Diet's important, and exercise is important. But he said there are another two things that are equally important. Music and davening. Those are the things. And he quoted from Aristotle, who said those four things, you need diet, you need exercise, you need music, and you need to daven. So luckily he didn't get onto the davening area. But on the... He got onto diet and he got exercise, and he said, no, and what about music? So he arranged in the evening to bring around a trio of musicians. One was his wife and two young musicians from the Stellenbosch Music Academy. And the at the timing there. And they played some beautiful Baroque music. And afterwards I was talking to him, and we were analyzing the impact of that and what was good about it and how it impacts on health. And we were talking about music and different kinds of music and the impact of different kinds of music upon health. And he said to me, but you still haven't touched on the most important thing of all. And I thought and I thought and I said, what is it? What do you mean? He said the fact that it was live music, that they were real musicians. He said, I could have brought a hi-fi system here, and we could have played CDs of the finest orchestras in the world. And you wouldn't have had the same health effect as watching these three young people play. Why not? Because there's human contact. Energy passes from one to the other. Smiles pass. You clap them and they look radiant, and they're radiant and they play better, and they play better and you feel better. And the result of that is a dynamic taking place between the audience and the performer. He said it's that dynamic which is important, not the music. It's the relationship between you and the performer, and you lose that with a hi-fi set. Rather listen to an inferior live performance than to a superior CD canned performance. And there's so much in that. The understanding of how people can infect one another. How they can infect one another with joy and with happiness. You watch a performer who really loves it, who really enjoys it. And that's part of the problem with studying by means of textbooks and correspondence, that the difference between learning by oneself and coming to a shir. Come to a shir and see a magid shir who loves the Gemara, who loves the learning, who's enthusiastic. That's what infects, that's what inspires one. Not the words. The words don't inspire. The words are information. The inspiration is from a one-on-one contact. From seeing it, you might be one person in a hall of 2,000 people. It doesn't matter. There's still that contact. And it's that contact that nourishes. It's that contact that makes people feel good. It's that contact that makes people feel that they can absorb the enthusiasm of others and give back of their own enthusiasm and feed and nourish one another. We can expand our capacity for happiness so much further if we realize that we can infect each other with happiness, that that's something that's possible to do, and that that's something that needs to be done. And if we develop that capacity, and that's a capacity that has to be practiced, this isn't something you can just go out and do. I've often wondered, in fact, with all these Matzah Shabbos Shirim, I've been giving Matzah Shabbos Shirim now for, I don't know, for nearly 15 years probably. How much really gets practiced? People come, they listen, it's nice. They hear some good ideas, and then sometimes they say it over. But how much of it actually gets translated into practice? And I believe virtually nothing. I believe very, very little. Because practice means just that. It means you take something, you ask yourself what you've learned, and you walk out of this door and you start doing it. That's what it means. And I think that happens very seldom. But one walks out of the door and one starts doing it. And starting to doing it means you walk out and you look around at other people and you watch other people. And when you see somebody who's unhappy, you try and help him if you can. And you identify with his unhappiness and you say, "Aren't I lucky?" And if you see somebody that's happy, you share in that happiness and you say, "Isn't he lucky? Isn't that lovely for him? Isn't that fantastic? It's so nice to see happy people. Because happy people infect me, they make me feel happy as well. It's wonderful. I would much rather be surrounded." Ask yourself, would you rather be surrounded with happy people or with miserable people? You know, most people are in quite some conflict when you ask that question. Because if you're surrounded by happy people, then you start worrying, why am I so miserable? And why have they got it? If they're happy, they're happy with all the things they've got, and I don't have it. I would much rather be surrounded with people who are happy, with people who are well off, who are doing nicely, who are healthy, who've got lovely families. I would much rather be surrounded by that, because that's infectious. That inspires me too. Rather that I should be the happiest person around and everybody else should be miserable. It's the last thing I would want. I would rather be the least happy person around and be surrounded by happy people than be the happiest person around and be surrounded by miserable people. So either way, if one's looking at happy people to rejoice and say, "Isn't that wonderful that they're happy people? If only there were more of them. It's too wonderful. I enjoy. Look at that smile on that person's face. Isn't it beautiful? Look at that delight on that person's face. Look how that young couple are walking. Isn't it beautiful? They're so happy. They're so in love. Isn't that so beautiful? That's so joyful. Isn't that marvelous?" To be able to look at what other people have got and rejoice in it. If one can do that, one expands one's possibilities for simcha. And one does something else too. One insulates oneself against any possibility of faribul. When a person gets faribuled, I feel very sorry for them. Not for the faribul. The faribul is nothing usually. It's nonsense. The fact that they're faribuled means they're unhappy. Means they're unfulfilled. Means they're dissatisfied. It means they haven't yet developed the capacity to take pleasure in what other people are doing. It really doesn't matter. Recently I was at a place where I was overlooked by mistake. I was supposed to be honored in this in a particular way, and there were colleagues of mine who had no real right to be honored the way they were. I had much more of a right, but it was a mistake. I was just overlooked, and a most beautiful thing happened to me. I noticed it only afterwards, that I was spending my time watching the particular colleagues who got those honors really needed it. They didn't deserve it, but they really needed it. It was important for them. They needed the upliftment. It was terribly important for them. And I remember standing there and feeling, that's so nice for them. That's so nice that they've got this opportunity. I don't need it. It's fine. I don't need it. And I can enjoy the fact that they can come away with a smile on their faces, feeling dignified, feeling good, feeling important. That's really good for them. It's really important for them. It doesn't have to always feel that one's got the raw end of the stick. On the contrary, one can take great pleasure in the fact that other people are rejoicing, that other people are celebrating, that other people are happy. I told the ladies this morning, I was called into a company a couple of weeks ago where there was a great deal of distress because the company had introduced an incentive program, and not a very well thought out incentive program, and it resulted in a few people in the company earning vast amounts of money for a particular project, and everybody else got nothing. And the company nearly closed down. There was nearly strikes, and they can't imagine what was going on with the place. And I had to take the people and say, "You're angry. What are you angry about?" "Angry because they got lots and lots of money." "Did the money come from you? Have you got any less money? Did they take money away from you to give it to them?" "No." "Are you going to be compromised in any way in the future? Do you think you'll get less money because of that?" No. On the contrary, do you think maybe you'll benefit from the fact that they got all this money and that will motivate them to do better and to sell more and the whole company will do... Yeah, that's possible. So I said, no, instead of talking about strike, how about we'll make a party for these people? Let's celebrate. Let's have a party. Let's enjoy the fact that there are people here who made so much money. That's wonderful. What's there to get angry about? And we turned the anger into celebration. One can do it so easy if we'll just open ourselves up to it. And that way, not only is it Tov Lach Ba'ilam Habo, not only will we get to Ilam Habo, but it's Ashrecha Ba'ilam Hazeh. And yes, Lefum Tzaro Igro. The reward is in accordance with the suffering. But the suffering doesn't mean unhappiness. The suffering means discomfort. And what that means is the more I am, or the less I am dependent on having to make me happy, and I'm able to be happy even when I don't have. Like those people who stood, those Talmidim of Rabban Shimon ben Yochai, who stood in the valley with all these gold coins, and they didn't need the gold coins. They were happy without it. It wasn't going to add to their happiness. They didn't want it. And like the wife of Rabban Shimon ben Chalaf, who says, take it back, give it back to God. I don't want it. I can have a lovely Shabbos without it. Not saying I can survive without it. I can be happy without it. So we've got nothing to eat. Good, but we'll enjoy the fact that other people have got what to eat. It doesn't matter. We have the capacity to enjoy other people's fortune. We don't have to have our own fortune. That's what Chazal mean by Lefum Tzairo Igru. And that's why it's no contradiction to the pleasure principle. Of course we're meant to be have pleasure. But the pleasure is not meant to come only from our own comfort. The pleasure is meant to come from the comfort, from the achievements, from the possessions, from the joys and from the simcha, not only of our own close ones, our dear ones and our friends, but of all of Klal Yisrael.